agus Giadiv. Welcome to The Irish in Canada, the podcast exploring the histories and legacies of Irish immigrants and their Canadian descendants. I'm your host, Jane McGaughey. This is Season 3, Episode Number 1, Benjamin Lett, the Rob Roy of Canada. It was nearly 4 o'clock in the morning. A full moon shone down on the towering pillar as it loomed over the old battlefield on the Niagara Peninsula. At that hour, not many people would have been awake to see what was happening, which was unfortunate, because in those early hours before dawn, there was a lot to see. April is usually a gloomy month in Ontario. The sunlight is fairly wan until later in the spring, and the nights can be cold, even frosty. Maybe the perpetrators left telltale footprints in the damp grass. Maybe a farmer, starting his day while it was still dark, looked up at the escarpment and spotted furtive movement near the base of the monument. We'll never know. What we do know is that on Good Friday morning, April 17th, 1840, at roughly 4 o'clock in the morning, the Brock Monument exploded. The blast echoed across the land, although it wouldn't have been loud enough to drown out the roar of Niagara Falls, some 10 kilometers away. The Brock Monument was a 135-foot-tall Tuscan column that had been erected on the 1812 battlefield of Queenston Heights to mark the graves of General Sir Isaac Brock, the hero of Upper Canada, and his aide-de-camp, Lieutenant Colonel John MacDonnell. In terms of physical iconography, it was one of the most imposing symbols of the British Empire's power in the Canadas in the first half of the 19th century. Looking back, this made it a clear target for what we now might call an act of domestic terrorism in the aftermath of the 1837 rebellions. Isaac Brock had been the great hero of the War of 1812, shot down by an American sniper's bullet as he led the vanguard of his forces in their attack on Queenston Heights. Some of you might remember a few of my thoughts on Brock from our first season's episode on Colonel James Fitzgibbon, a fascinating man, brilliant general. But running uphill in a scarlet tunic was one of the dumber ideas in Canadian history. To attack the physical representation of Brock's memory in the colony he had died to protect was a deliberate assault on the British Empire itself, let alone blowing up his actual tomb. Amazingly, the structure was still standing after the explosion, but it was irrevocably damaged. You can see an artist's rendition of this in the show notes on our website. The pedestal was cracked on one side, the main column split from top to bottom, and the wooden staircase inside was a mass of ruins. At first, no one knew who was behind the shocking destruction of Brock's monument. The British colonist newspaper feared that, quote, "The perpetrators of this act are amongst ourselves, mixing daily with the community, and not far from the scenes of their iniquity. Such an act could only be perpetrated by devils incarnate," end quote. Within a week of the explosion, that devil had a name, Benjamin Lett. 3 days after the explosion, a letter forwarded to the government revealed that an American informant had seen, quote, "the notorious Lett enter a tavern in Buffalo a short time ago, armed with pistols and Bowie knives," end quote. Lett had held up a fuse for mass explosions to the other patrons of the bar, and then grinned, letting everyone see that he was going to target something enormous. The British colonist newspaper declared that one of the criminals behind the explosion, quote, "was Lett, an individual implicated in most, if not all, the outrages committed on this frontier," end quote. That was a bit of an exaggeration. On the other hand, Benjamin Lett somehow just kept turning up at the center of all sorts of scandals and crimes across Upper Canada. The words used to describe him in some of the historical sources were colorful, to say the least. Miscreant, notorious, wicked, lawless, villainous, piratical, incendiary, and a scoundrel. And Irish, of course. Say what you will about Benjamin Lett, and while he was alive, people said a lot, but his Irishness was always absolute. Now, you might be questioning the title of this episode. Jane, you might say, surely you of all people would know that Rob Roy was a Highlander and a Scottish folk hero, and Benjamin Lett was from County Wexford. Don't let your abiding affection for the man from Ballymena blind you to the fact that there is a keen difference between a Scot and an Irishman that no Liam Neeson movie can cure. I hear you. I know. I understand. Don't blame me, because I actually didn't come up with it. Blame Lieutenant Governor Sir George Arthur. He was the one who wrote to Governor General Lord Sydenham that, quote, the wicked attempt to destroy the monument was the deed of Benjamin Lett, the Rob Roy of Upper Canada, who is always prowling about our frontier, devising and committing all manner of mischief, end quote. I admit, I think of Rob Roy in a rather positive light, not just because of the movie, but because the story of the real Robert Roy MacGregor is, in my opinion, one of a wronged man locked in an ongoing feud with a narrow-minded aristocrat that involved a lot of cattle raiding and theft, but no major bloodshed. The story of Benjamin Lett is not that. Yes, both men were outlaws, but that's kind of where the parallels end. Ben Lett wasn't Robin Hood or Sirius Black or the dread pirate Roberts. He was bloodthirsty. For a time, he was one of, if not the, most infamous Irishmen in the Canadas. And then time moved on, and he was fairly forgotten. But not by me. And after this episode, maybe not by you either. Born in County Kilkenny in 1813, Benjamin Lett was raised in County Wexford. His family were Irish Protestants with some French Huguenot ancestry. When he was not quite 6 years old, the family emigrated to Lower Canada, modern Quebec, to become what most Irish immigrants to the Canadas were, farmers. The Letts were part of a wave of Irish immigrants that headed west across the ocean in the years immediately following the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the fabled year without a summer that had caused a famine in Ireland in 1817. Ben's father, Samuel, settled the family near the Ottawa River, but he died in a farm accident 5 years later. About a decade after that, in the early 1830s, the Letts moved to a new farm in Darlington Township on Lake Ontario, just outside of present-day Oshawa. And that was where the trouble started. For the first 25 years of his life, Ben lived the same story as most Irish immigrants to the Canadas. He left Ireland, making the long crossing over the Atlantic Ocean in the summer sailing season before traveling up the mighty St. Lawrence River. Sources described him as a tall man with a slim build, sandy red hair and whiskers, light skin that freckled easily, large, muscular hands, and, quote, remarkably penetrating light blue eyes. A similar description would have fit thousands of other Irish arrivals in North America. For Ben Lett, something went wrong. History reached out and marked him among that sea of hundreds of thousands of unknown immigrants. What was it that set Ben off? What made him go from being an anonymous Irish farmer to a vigilante, arsonist, kidnapper, murderer, and for a time, the most wanted man in Upper Canada? The triggering event, and I know regular listeners of the podcast will be shocked to hear this, appears to have involved the Orangemen, because of course it did. The colony was still reeling from the aftermath of William Lyon Mackenzie's failed rebellion in December 1837. The atmosphere was heavy with resentment, vindictiveness, and cruelty. The Letts had taken no part in the rebellion itself. His brother Thomas later recalled that the family had generally supported the government, but that they were, quote, loyalists, not bloodhounds, Protestants, but not Orangemen, end quote. In fact, the Letts already had a lengthy history with rebellion and its aftermath, going back to the 1798 Irish Rising. Ben's mother, Elizabeth Warren, had only been 11 years old that year, but she had still been imprisoned twice by the United Irishmen. her brother, Benjamin's namesake, had been hanged. Secondary accounts suggest that Elizabeth might have been raped or sexually molested during the Rising, but this isn't mentioned in the family's version. Whatever the extent of her experiences with violence, the 1798 Rising turned Elizabeth against that kind of physical force nationalism, but she also refused to forgive the local Orange militia officers who had failed to save her brother's life. Hatred for both sectarianism and British authority was her children's inheritance. In early 1838, the Orangemen arrived on horseback at the Letts farm, fully armed. They had been there before, wanting Ben to join their mob in hunting down reformer sympathizers. He'd shown zero interest in doing anything like that. Now they were back to make him pay for saying no. It's not clear exactly what happened when the Orangemen dismounted and surrounded the Letts property. The Dictionary of Canadian Biography repeats the story that his, quote, hatred of the British stemmed from an incident involving Orangemen in which one of his brothers was shot and a sister was sexually abused, end quote. From this day on, Ben Lett was hell-bent on a lifestyle defined by violence. On November 16th, 1838, the same day the American invaders surrendered at the Battle of the Windmill, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, Captain Edgeworth Usher heard some kind of clatter outside of his front door in Chippewa, near Niagara Falls. It had been almost a year since Usher had helped to chase down the rebel leader William Lyon Mackenzie, piloting the crew across the Niagara River that had then raided and burned Mackenzie's supply ship called the Caroline. This made Usher a hero among loyalists, but a target for rebel sympathizers. Usher was awakened in the middle of the night by his friend Mr. Taylor banging loudly on the door. "It's me," came the voice. "Taylor, open up." "That is you," replied Usher, reassured. What he couldn't know was that Taylor was there under duress, held hostage by two armed men who had dragged him to Usher's house. Taylor was calling out to his friend with a gun to his head. The candle that Usher had brought with him to light the way in the dark was his undoing. It gave Ben Lett just enough of a sight line to fire through a side window, shooting Usher straight through the heart. In its coverage of the murder, the Niagara Courier warned that this crime was, quote, but the introductory act to a reign of terror, end quote. How prophetic. Ben operated as a guerrilla fighter of sorts for the rebel cause on the frontier, often working by himself, but sometimes also with others. After Usher's murder, Ben was next seen at the other end of Lake Ontario, trying to burn the British fleet anchored at Kingston. 6 months after that, he was part of a plan to rob, abduct, and kill key members of the family compact in a raid on the city of Cobourg. Ben crossed Lake Ontario from New York State with Samuel Hart and Henry J. Moon, armed to the teeth. He was noted for often having at least 4 pistols in his belt, as well as his favorite Bowie knife. The raid failed. Realizing they were in over their heads, some of the conspirators alerted the authorities. Almost everyone was arrested, but Ben didn't get caught, jumping out a window at the last minute and vanishing back to the American side of the border. After the failed Cobourg conspiracy, the bounty on his head was raised by the lieutenant governor to £500. In the end, however, it was the Americans who caught and arrested him in June 1840 for the attempted arson of a Canadian steamship in Oswego, New York. He was convicted and sentenced to 7 years hard labor. But then he escaped from the train that was taking him to the prison. I know, this sounds like something from The Fugitive, except I bet even Hollywood would think twice before giving someone that many last-minute escapes. For the next year, Ben was a fugitive on either side of the border. He was blamed for an explosion that occurred on the Welland Canal, because by this point, it was hard to imagine he wouldn't have been involved in any major crime in the colony. Finally, he was recaptured in Buffalo in September 1841, taken to prison, and thrown into solitary confinement. According to the history written by his brother Thomas, the guards, quote, frequently fastened him with his head drawn backwards in stocks and poured water on his face, risking his almost instant death by strangling, end quote. Welcome to waterboarding, 1840 style. Lett was in prison for nearly 4 years. With his health totally broken, he received a pardon from Governor Silas Wright in 1845 and joined his brothers and sisters on a farm in Illinois, where they had eventually settled after fleeing Upper Canada. That was almost the end of Benjamin Lett's story. But a character like that couldn't just have an easy death, and Ben certainly didn't. Even though he wasn't in Canada any longer, that didn't mean he or his crimes had been forgotten. While on a trading expedition in Milwaukee at the end of 1858, he mysteriously died of strychnine poisoning. His brother Thomas was convinced that it was the work of British agents. A few weeks later, knowing the truth couldn't hurt Ben any longer, he was finally identified as the mastermind behind the destruction of the Brock Monument by William Lyon Mackenzie's son, James. The January edition of his newspaper, the Allen County Democrat, described how from his Lewiston, New York hideout, Benjamin Lett had a clear view of General Brock's memorial and had decided it was an eyesore that needed to disappear. After getting a keg of gunpowder from some friends, Lett had smuggled it across the Niagara River and placed it underneath the monument's inner spiral staircase. However, the fuse went off sooner than Ben had expected, and he was nearly killed by the massive chunks of debris raining down around him. "He got off, however," wrote James Mackenzie, "and the monument was a wreck." James Mackenzie had known Benjamin Lett. He, too, was convinced that something terrible had happened in the past that turned an Irishman like Lett against the British. Quote, "We always have believed that a great wrong had stung him to exhibit the vengeful energy which marked his short career," end quote. James Mackenzie also found some kind of poetic irony in a violent Irishman like Benjamin Lett not having an easy death. Quote, "As wild and reckless as he was, it seems that his desperate and violent career in its ending could not escape at least the suspicion of violence," end quote. Benjamin Lett is either a hero or a villain, depending on a certain point of view. His personal embrace of violence and guerrilla warfare, some 80 years before Michael Collins and the IRA adopted similar tactics against the British, strengthened the idea of Irishmen as an aggressive, disorderly, and disloyal presence in Upper Canada. Ben, of course, was an aberration in that regard. Most Irishmen who came to Canada were not murderous, rebellious, politically agitated, or likely to blow things up. Was Benjamin Lett the Rob Roy of Upper Canada? Perhaps. Personally, I think comparing him with Australia's own Irish rebel Ned Kelly might be a better fit. Interesting coda. The same year that Ben Lett died, a new Brock monument was erected on Queenston Heights. It still stands there today. This column is even taller and grander than the first one, almost 184 feet tall, and topped by a statue of General Sir Isaac Brock himself, his arm raised in permanent defiance of his enemies. I think it's a gesture that both the British general and the Irish rebel could appreciate. Thanks for listening to The Irish in Canada. The show was researched, written, and narrated by me, Jane McGaughey. This season was edited and mixed by Patrick McMaster and produced by Marianne Mulvena. Our theme music was composed and performed by Kate Bevan Baker, and our logo was designed by Claire McCauley. Many thanks to the School of Irish Studies at Concordia University in Montreal, the Canadian Irish Studies Foundation, Le Gouvernement de Québec, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada for their support. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. You can spread the word about the Irish in Canada by following us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Irish Canada Pod. Our website is the Irish in Canada Podcast.ca. That's where you can find show notes for our episodes, including lists of sources and recommendations for further reading. Until next time, go to Maagif.